Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, August 28th. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us once again to talk about recent events, developments, technologies, and news in the field of climate change and alternative energy research is Dan DeLury, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law and Graduate School. Dan has over 25 years' experience, including as an executive with utilities and clean energy companies. If you have a climate change question or a question about some of these new renewable and clean energy technologies, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Dan DeLury and your climate change calls coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Here to take your climate change and alternative energy questions is Dan DeLury, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law and Graduate School. Dan has over 25 years' experience as an exec with utilities and clean energy companies, presenting at congressional hearings, federal and state agency hearings, White House special events, a UN-accredited delegation head to the UN climate change meetings known as COPs. Dan is considered a pioneer in developing content, policy, and programs that combine climate change with new electricity technologies. You have a question for Dan today? 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Feel free to email if you'd like to do that instead, if you're shy. voxpop@wamc.org is the email, and the number is 800-348-2551. Dan DeLury, welcome back.
Well, hello, Ray. Thanks for being a guest on my show today.
Isn't that something? You're off. I was on my show. Okay.
Sorry, the story behind this is I posted something on LinkedIn related to my appearance here. And, you know, you don't want to use up too many characters.
Right.
So instead of explaining what Vox Pop is, I simply said, you know, my show, my radio show. And so I get an immediate message from Ray. You have a radio show?
Well, you know what? I'm a volunteer anyway, so that's fine. Hey, what's happening, man?
Well, I mean, all sorts of things in the world of climate and clean energy. A lot of good things, but as you know, I'm always saying maybe not enough good things, or maybe not in the sufficient magnitude.
Yeah.
You know, my new way of referring to this or explaining it, it's like a race. And so if you're running in a race and you increase your pace, that's a good thing. But if you don't increase it to the point where you overtake the other runner,
right,
then, you know, to what end? And that's sort of where we are with trying to tackle climate. A lot of good things are happening, but we're not acting fast enough to really win in the end.
Well, you know, you have a is it Substack? No, it's just a newsletter.
It's
that
a
you
newsletter
sent out.
That I put out. Yeah.
And the headline on the most recent one: two guys walk into a bar and talk about energy. Just give us a quick précis of that.
Well, sure. And that's an old joke that I heard 25 or 30 years ago, told at an energy conference. And so the two guys start talking about energy, and the one guy says, "Well, what's your favorite kind of energy?" And the guy says, "Well, I don't like oil because of, you know, it's too dirty and all those oil spills." And the guy says, "Yeah, right. I don't like coal either because, you know, it's a really problem. It's dirty and so on." And the other guy says, "Yeah, and natural gas. I mean, all those pipelines all over running into buildings and so on, and it just seems dangerous." And then the other guy says, "Yeah, and nuclear. I mean, you've always got a problem with nuclear." And so the other guy says, "Which one do you really like?" And the other guy says, "You know, I really like electricity."
Aha!
And at an energy conference, of course, they're rolling in the aisles,
right,
with laughter at this
so
point. But it really
they're
goes
easily entertained, is what you're saying.
Well, but it goes to the point that, you know, we sort of take energy for granted when we flip the light switch.
Yeah.
And what's important in the battle against climate change is what's producing that electricity, and how much are we reducing the electricity demand, and what are we allowing to increase the demand, such as crypto.
Okay. So you would be in the camp that says crypto, no, no.
Well,
I don't even know how to explain crypto,
well,
and nor do I have any money to invest in it. So I'm agnostic on this.
Yeah. I mean, crypto, you have to sort of face it from a climate standpoint of what is it really providing in terms of a benefit versus the fact that in some cases, I mean, there's a case in New York now where a crypto miner is suing the state of New York because they're being told to not use a coal plant to do their calculations to produce crypto.
Is that in the Finger Lakes?
I saw that
headline.
It's somewhere in Western New York or whatever. And I mean, I got into a tangle on a call, and there were a lot of people and a lot of crypto folks were on there, and we really got into a tussle, and they said, well, we should have the right to do whatever we want to. And of course, from a capitalistic standpoint, of course, but you know, you shouldn't be able to go unrestricted to what your effect is on emissions and global warming would be the way I look at it. So it's too bad, but crypto, you've got to look at the emissions from crypto.
We're joined today by Dan DeLore, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law and Graduate School. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. Well, in mid-July, pieces of a turbine from off the shore of Massachusetts started rolling up onto, what was it, Martha's Vineyard? I'm not sure exactly where it was.
Nantucket, actually.
Yeah, oh, Nantucket, okay. And there was a lot of stuff that washed up. Now, there are many people out there, fishermen and whatnot, who are not jazzed about the idea of offshore wind. As a person who is involved and maybe at the cutting edge of sort of people's beliefs and trying to shape opinion, how do you fix that PR disaster?
Well, let me start by segueing from the crypto comments that I made a moment ago. If it wasn't for emissions, I could care less about crypto. You know, let them calculate away and create this entire new currency. But the currency we all should be concerned about is emissions. And so the reason that we have wind and solar scaling up to the extent it is because we all are looking for a technology solution to climate change. And those are technology solutions. Those are what we are sort of accepting or endorsing, even if not actively. But passively, we are endorsing trying to still have a lot of electricity and have it in a way that doesn't increase global warming. So that brings us to wind and solar. The wind farms, in most cases, are opposed for reasons of aesthetics. People don't want to see them offshore. Second degree to that, I think, is the effect on whales, which, to my understanding, has not been proven yet.
All right, let me stop you there.
Yeah, sure.
And there is, in fact, I think of this great article from WBUR called The Fallout from Vineyard Wind's Broken Turbine Blade, which was from August 1st.
Right.
You know, somebody mentioned from the industry, well, the government is looking into potential effects on maritime sea life, aquatic life from these offshore turbines. And many, you know, if you have a group of them spaced a mile apart out X number of miles, shouldn't they have studied that before they put them in? In other words,
well, I think they have some evidence, as I just said or alluded to. I don't think it was not thought of, but I think there's been enough concern, and maybe there's new evidence. I don't know. But yes, I think many things continue to get studied even after something is implemented. But I don't know the specifics in terms of what study was done on whales, when, and what's about to happen.
Now, to be honest with you, I get seasick and I don't fish. I don't have a horse in this race.
But again, I think that the key phrase here is as opposed to what? Okay? because we, I mean, no one likes an oil spill. No one likes a gas pipeline explosion. No one likes a coal mine and all of the coal waste and leveling mountaintops and all of that. And people are afraid of nuclear because of the nuclear accidents we've had. So, you know, as opposed to what? And so the key is to make, since emissions is the ultimate criteria, it's to make the emissions-free electricity facilities or resources as safe as possible.
In this specific case, I think this was a GE subsidiary who has this Vineyard Wind with the broken turbine. They said, okay, we discovered that it was an unfortunate manufacturing
error. Calling it a factory problem, yes.
Right. They're planning on doing more of these. Again, will we be seeing huge? These blades are enormous.
Oh, enormous, yeah.
And the amount of stuff that came in on those shores was a lot. This is a problem. This is a problem, yeah?
It's the same problem as oil spills, I would say. I don't know what the difference is.
That doesn't really, that's
no.
Apples and oranges doesn't really do it.
No, except that with a wind turbine, you are avoiding emissions, and you're not doing that with oil. That's the bottom line.
Okay, so you're all right. That's collateral damage.
Well, nothing is perfect. We all seek to make things perfect, but the ultimate currency is greenhouse gases, and that's the bottom line.
All right, Dan DeLurie is our guest today. Let's take a break here. The phone lines are loading up. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. You can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. And we'll check the email bag in a moment. First, some underwriting. Fox Pop on WAMC, Ray Graff with you. It's Climate Change and Alternative Energy with Dan DeLurie, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law at Graduate School. Before we get to the email bag, how's the EV running for you, man?
Oh, it's great.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I love it. I can't think of any reason not to have one.
I got to tell you, one of my guests this week, I won't say which guest, had a beautiful Tesla outside. And it was just a gorgeous car. I mean, I wanted to so badly to drive that thing.
Did you?
No.
Okay.
Actually, she didn't offer.
Oh.
But it's fine.
You can drive mine after the show. We can go out and have fun.
I don't think yours will go as fast as this one probably does.
No, I think mine probably goes.
Really?
Yes.
Faster than the Tesla? She said it was heavy. That's one thing. It was a slightly older, 4 or 5 years older, and it was a pretty heavy vehicle.
Well, they're all heavy. The batteries are heavy, and that has advantages and disadvantages. I mean, having a heavier car in the snow and all of that can be good, but there's extra wear on the tires.
Yeah.
You know, there's almost zero maintenance on an EV. I mean, there are no fluids. You've got, you know, if you use it properly with the regenerative braking function, then...
What do you mean use it properly? You have to learn how to brake?
No, you're not. I take whole trips without touching the brake.
Huh?
Yeah, it's called regenerative braking.
Is this one of those Flintstone cars where you put your feet on the ground?
No, when you back off, and I don't know exactly how it works, so you can ask Gordon Fricke when he's on. But when you back off, it slows down like almost immediately.
Incredible.
Without a brake. I mean, I can time it so that I end up stopped at a stop sign as I approach it without ever touching the brake.
You know, one of the things she said was that there's a small sort of marine-type battery in the either in the cabin or underneath that handles the electronics on the vehicle.
Yeah, I didn't even know that.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I'm teaching you stuff.
Yeah, well, thank you.
And
you're
the senior fellow at Vermont Law. Okay, all right, let's go.
Yeah, well, the reason I said it's faster is there's a Tesla offers a performance model, and I didn't mean to get that, but it happened to be available, and it qualified.
Oh.
I want to remind everyone, $7,500 federal tax credit. That's off the bottom line of what you owe to the federal government. On the
assuming you can afford the down payment on the Tesla.
There are other incentives. We've talked about them before. Yeah, yeah. We have so many callers here, we probably should.
Oh, I see. I understand. Well, it is your show. Janet writes in, I'm very interested in heat transfer on geothermal technologies. Are there good consultants who can advise on the best solutions for my older house?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, I've not seen ads, and I read like Green Energy Times and Green Energy News, which have a lot of ads for people that are providing, you know, zero emissions homes and solar and wind and so on. And I don't recall seeing a lot of people talking about, you know, installing geothermal at your home. I know it happens, but I'm just not familiar with that bunch of companies or whatever. What I would say, as I often say, is, you know, go to your state Department of Energy or energy office, and I guarantee there might even be a list of qualified companies. There often is at the state level. They put together companies that automatically qualify for the tax credit in the case of some of these measures.
All right, this is from Aaron in Greenfield, Massachusetts. On a previous show, you had stated that even if solar panels were to be mounted on all the existing parking lots and building rooftops across America, that wouldn't be enough power to supply our country's demand. How can that be? Have you seen the size of the parking lots at Six Flags or Home Depots, for instance? And that's from Aaron in Greenfield.
Well, I've seen the statistics. That's what I was quoting that day, and it was a while ago, but I think it would only be able to do 60% or something like that. I mean, there is an existing number. Someone has run the numbers looking at, and that was commercial space, commercial flat top space. I don't know if it included parking lots. I think it did, but I know that the numbers have been run. I wasn't just feeling that day, and there's not enough. And again, remember, things have to be in the right places, okay? Yeah. I mean, right now, we have an abundance of wind and solar in the U.S. that's in the wrong place.
What, underground? What do you mean?
No, it's in the geographically.
Oh, I see. So northeast
is no... It's so far away from the Midwest, what they call load pockets, like Chicago in that area and California. And so that means you've got to build transmission lines. There's a line loss in when you transmit electricity over long distances. But in fact, that's interesting, I think, for people to know. But the normal number used is only one-third of the energy that goes into a power plant in the form of the coal or the gas or whatever actually ends up usable at the plug in your house. One-third.
We have to be better.
Well, we have to be better. We need plants that are more efficient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. This is from Paul in Newburgh. What's the future of small modulator reactor? What is that?
Well,
Dan, senior fellow, tell me what that is.
Think of it as just a small...
Nuke?
Nuke, yeah. It's a small nuke. I don't think they're talking about putting them on the back of a truck yet and, you know, bringing them around to be modular in that sense, but it's basically a small nuclear reactor. They've been talked about for decades, and there are some that are being deployed. Some of the big users of electricity, such as Google and Meta and these other people who are trying to reduce their emissions, and so they are commissioning their own power plants. They're building their own solar farms. But I think it was Google recently that they have plans to have their own small nuclear unit that just serves some of their data farms.
See, there you go. I'd like to have one too. Could you get me one of those? Susie in Northfield says, you haven't mentioned hydroelectric as an energy source. Where does it fall on your rating scale? And do you foresee there could ever be a place for household micro hydro generators?
Well, thank you for that, because if I haven't mentioned hydro, I'm not the only one that sometimes forgets to mention it. It's the oldest form of harnessing energy, really. I mean, going back to water wheels and whatever else.
Dutch had windmills,
but it's Yeah, but I don't think that the windmills couldn't be harnessed to the extent that the water could.
Okay.
New England, the Industrial Revolution was built on water generated power.
Yeah.
To use in the mills and so on. So we have, I think the number is about 10% of the U.S. electricity is provided by hydro. Now, when you look at a hydro number, some of it is, you know, small hydro, as in, a dam somewhere on a lake, even up to the Hoover Dam. Then you have the big hydro north of us in Hydro Quebec. I mean, these are massive dams that are sending power down to the U.S. But hydro is emissions-free. And starting again with the theme that we were on earlier, nothing is perfect, and hydro is not perfect. Hydro on a river has affected salmon runs,
sure.
Fish runs,
yeah.
Recreation, various other things. And so hydro has not grown much over the decades. It stayed kind of static. And if anything, some dams across the country are being dismantled to allow run of river again. But and I want to give a special shout out to pumped hydro, because that's a form of storage. And there's a pretty big plant right over in the Berkshires on the Deerfield River.
Explain how that works.
Pumped hydro means that you run the water up, pump it up to the top of a mountain where a reservoir has been built, and you use low-cost power, possibly emissions-free power if it's nuclear, and then when you need it during the peak period the next day, you run it down through a turbine
like
and produce electricity
toilet.
And put it back. Well, I hadn't thought of that, but...
But the thing is, man, I mean, I don't know too much about the laws of thermodynamics and energy and everything else, but you're using energy to bring it up to that high point
yes.
so that the potential energy can be there.
Yes.
Is it efficient?
It's normally been done if it's cost efficient, because remember, the cost of power to produce power fluctuates throughout the day.
Yeah.
And the reason that some people have taken advantage of time of use rates, I mean, homeowners and businesses, is because they can buy electricity cheaper in the middle of the night, because the grid always uses the cheapest production facility that it has when the power demand goes up. And so it keeps on adding the next most expensive, the next most expensive, and so on. And so it really is cost efficient. But also from an emission standpoint, depending on what you're using, a lot of wind blows at night, nuclear plants have to run 24 hours. So you've got low emissions ways to pump that up. So, you know, another form of efficiency,
okay.
If it's emissions efficient.
Dan DeLore is our guest today. Dan is the Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law and Graduate School. And last email, then we'll hit the phones. Anna Newpaltz, you'll be first. Hang in there another minute. This is from Rich in Niskayuna. What's your opinion of the future of fuel cells that emit only water and oxygen?
I don't know enough about the technology. I'm certainly not up on what's going on with them. I mean, fuel cells have been like nuclear fusion, sort of, it's just around the corner. And it's kind of like, you know, free beer tomorrow when you go into the bar. And
but they use fuel cells now.
They do use fuel cells, but in terms of widespread deployment and massive scale and size, they haven't come along as quickly as possible. No one is expecting them to not be part of the mix. But in terms of where they're at,
okay.
I just can't comment on that one.
All right, let's hit the phones. Dan DeLore is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number. Anne in New Paltz, thank you for your patience. You're on.
Hi. I have a question about using the electricity that's produced by my solar panels in some kind of storage system with the goal of having it be available when I have a power outage. And I've been told about various pros and cons, but I'm interested in your take on this. I have 42 solar panels on my barn roof. It's a pretty big setup.
Thanks, Ian. I'd be interested, I guess, in what the cons are that you've heard. I mean, the only one I can think of is the cost. You know, as I always say on the show, if something is not cost effective, then even if it's a good thing, perhaps, you know, you don't want to do it. But otherwise, the home-based storage systems are available, and there are incentives available at the federal level and normally at the state level to help you put those in. But what kind of cons have you heard?
Well, cost was one, but I'm willing to spread that out and also be just a contributor to a better environmental solution. But the major obstacle was that the company that put my system in, I called them back and said, all right, I'm ready now to install my battery backup. And they said, well, the panels you have on your roof are, they were made in Israel, and I asked in the beginning that I was planning to want a battery storage, and they said, yes, yes, yes. And now I found that my company's not making them to interface, or the ones I have do not interface with any current batteries, like a Tesla Powerwall or anything like that. So they said my only option, it was Lighthouse Solar here in New Paltz, and I've really enjoyed working with them, said my only option was to replace all the solar panels on my roof with a kind of solar panel that interfaces with currently available battery storage systems. And
wow.
I balked at that. And then my other just final question is, how long can I hold that electricity, and how many days in the case of a big outage would I get out of my storage?
I think it depends on the type of battery, lead acid battery, it's set in NiCad, nickel metal hydride.
Yeah, I mean that's a variable answer depending on, you know, what you buy and how much storage. There are different sizes of power walls and so on. But to go back to
Well, they definitely said the Tesla power wall was completely incompatible. So what kind of power storage do you recommend?
Okay.
What kind of battery should I be looking for?
I mean, I'm not a solar technician, and so all I can say is I don't know why. I don't know why it would be incompatible.
It's probably connectors and things like that. I mean, you probably get a voltage regulator, and you could hook it up to whatever batteries you want, but safety is important. Some of these batteries need to be vented, and there are a lot of things you don't want to do by yourself, Ann.
No, but I don't think that's...
I'm not doing it by myself.
Okay.
It's just that the company I worked with said, sorry, we can't proceed.
No, I mean, it sounds like the company doesn't care that much about the battery. It's not like there's going to be backflow into the panels. It sounds like, why can't the electricity
Maybe there's a communications gap here, but Ann, I think that you could probably, where there is a will, there is a way. And you could probably work it out, but that's beyond the scope of the show.
I would call NYSERDA.
Oh, great idea.
Yeah, would call NYSERDA, the New York State Energy Research Development Authority.
Okay.
And they have a solar department, and I would ask them, because it doesn't sound right, but I wish I could tell you.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to Dave in New Windsor. Hello, Dave. You're on.
Yes. My question is, with the ratepayers, many of them can't afford their energy bill now. What do you suggest we do in the future that's cost effective for the ratepayers that can't turn their AC on and can't turn their heat on because they can't afford their bills, such as Central Hudson customers? 30% cannot pay their bills.
All right, Dave. Dan.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of facets to that, Dave. I mean, there is and long has been a program of weatherization assistance, but also bill assistance for low-income homeowners. So, you know, that continues. I'm not sure there's anything new with that program from any of the recent legislation or whatever. So... I think,
well,
you know,
it,
doesn't it mean that the ratepayers are paying for them or the taxpayers are paying for them? In other words, common sense says if it's ill-affordable to the masses, we got to do something different. Mm. I can afford it. I will afford it for the rest of my life. But there are many that cannot afford this plan, this grand scheme with solar and wind being so costly.
All right.
Yeah, I
Dave.
Think here's the one thing I'll say, and this is why I encourage people to get involved when there are public utility commission hearings about their local utility, be it rates or anything else, because the thing that determines what you pay is something called rate design. Okay, so utilities need to collect so much money based on their investments and everything else. And then they sit down, okay, how do we collect that money? How much do we get from small businesses? How much do we get from the residential sector? How much from the industrial sector? And then they decide, okay, how do we design these rates so that they're fair to everybody? And, you know, inevitably, they're not going to be fair to everyone because it's such a massive task. But that's really the way, if you want to try and make a difference on how rates end up, you sort of need to, you know, weigh in on. And Ray is giving me the sign here.
We have to take a break on your show. I mean, if it's okay. But listen, Dave brings up a point that a lot of people talk about. Electric rates go up, not just in the entity he spoke of, but everywhere.
Yeah.
And in some states, there are goals. There are renewable energy goals,
right.
And they're expensive. And so, what a lot of people out there say is, well, we end up paying more because it's essentially an unfunded mandate. You worked in utility companies. 30 seconds. How do you respond?
Well, I mean, the one thing about utility costs is regulators, whether you hate them, distrust them, or whatever, I mean, it's not like everything else you buy, like buying a car or whatever. There is some way, there's a little bit of guardrail against how utility rates are determined and what the costs are. But the other thing, quickly, is that solving climate change and reducing emissions is not going to be free. Electricity is subject to inflation, just like everything else that we buy. And so we have to be realistic about whether or not rates are going to go up. We need to expand the utility system, meaning the wire system. We need to invest in new plants. And the question is how we recover those types of costs in a fair manner.
All right. Let's go to a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Dan DeLury. He is it's his show. We'll be back. Yes, the man can play the guitar. That's Chuck DeLoya. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Just one email here before we go back to the phones with Dan DeLury. This is from David's Cat. David's Cat punctuates very well. My niece has a Tesla Model 3. The regenerative braking helps stop the car because the computer turns the electric motors into generators. Maybe it's alternators, says David's Cat. Locomotives with those huge diesel engines, that diesel engine only turns a generator. Generating the required electricity requires a lot of torque, which comes in handy for braking. My niece's Tesla outweighs my 62 GMC Suburban by 300 pounds. Her car accelerates from 0 to 60 in 4.8 seconds, which is probably fast enough. Certainly for a cat. And thank you for that. Let's go.
Thanks to the cat.
Right, indeed. Let's go to line, I don't know which line it is. Marie is in Rochester. Hello, Marie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, welcome.
Thank you. I think it's important to discuss the Champlain-Hudson direct current line from Montreal to New York City and the supply that will bring into the state.
Yeah.
In what sense, Marie?
Well, could you discuss it? Because I don't think a lot of people are aware, since the direct current and the current will be converted to AC once it gets to New York City.
Okay,
if you could discuss the when it's going to be ready, how, you know, what the,
yeah,
the, aspects of it.
We've done a few stories on parts of this project in the news department, but I'm not fully up to speed on this. Is this the same line where they're dropping 100 miles of cable and a lot of it's going at the bottom of Lake Champlain coming right down from Canada?
Yes, and going under the Hudson then from there into New York City.
So fascinating. I didn't know it was direct current, though.
Yes, it is direct current, and it will be converted at a converter site in the city.
Interesting.
That's why everybody's shocked that, it can't be direct current. Oh, yes, that's what it is.
Ha, that's fascinating. I know in the beginning, Tesla and Edison were fighting it out over AC power and DC power, and one of them, I forget which, Marie, had a much longer range without the degradation.
Yeah.
You have better efficiency.
Yeah.
But I'm no expert on
DC
this,
loss.
I got to be honest with you.
Yeah. But Marie, I'm sorry, I don't know any of the particulars on that project. I mean, obviously it's—
Oh, my gosh.
What?
I'm surprised.
Well, I can't follow every—
Yeah, Dan's more of a policy guy, to be honest with you.
Well, I mean, I can't follow every specific project. I try and be aware of them, and I try and delve down into them as I can. But
yeah.
There's a lot of projects going on. I mean, I actually work nationally, and so there's a lot of projects going on that I have to be aware of, but it's hard for me to know the specifics of each one.
Gotcha. Marie, thanks for the call. BA in Scotia says, for your information, the New York Power Authority's Blenheim-Gilboa project, southeast of Albany, is a pumped storage operation. It has a decent visitor center that has a pretty good display of how the operation works.
Yeah, that's great. I didn't mean to imply that the only local one was the one on the Deerfield River. So
and
that's
I think
great.
I deleted a very interesting one on, okay, here it is. This is from Telesport. As with other methods of generating energy, pumped hydro is not perfect. The modern American environmental law movement grew out of efforts in the 60s to stop Con Ed from turning the majestic Storm King on the Hudson into a pumped storage facility. After a Supreme Court win, the opponents, and about 10 years of contention, Con Edison gave up on that. The legacy of that effort is scenic Hudson.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with Storm King. I know of Storm King because some consider it the birth of the American environmental movement.
Right.
But this project that I refer to, it's called Bear Swamp over on the Deerfield, and I've been there. And basically, it has a doorway into a mountain. The entire plant, it's like a James Bond situation. You drive into the middle of the mountain, and they did build a reservoir on top, which can't be seen other than from the air or some tall mountain peaks.
Huh.
And then the water drops right straight down in the middle of the river. And so there's nothing to see. So in terms of the scenic damage done by a pumped hydro project, in the case of that one, there's none.
Okay. Believe it or not, some of our listeners are cynical. Chris writes, I'm 47. I've been hearing about saving the whales for as long as I can remember. Now, all of a sudden, wind turbines are the thing that gets people to rally about saving the whales? I don't think so. Nobody cares about saving the whales any more than they did 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. Clearly, the oil companies and the coal companies are looking for any excuse to get people not to use alternative energies.
There is evidence
that. That is from
that.
Chris. That is not from this.
There is evidence of that.
That
yes.
is not our editorial department yes. here at the station. That is a listener email. All right, let's go back to the phones. 800, is that all right?
Yes.
Okay, good. 800-348-2551 is the number. Dan DeLore is our guest. Wolfgang is in Albany. Wolfgang, go ahead.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Thank you for being here.
I got two questions, actually. You know, listening to Dan, I agree, you know, emission cutting is important. But I was wondering what is his perspective also, you know, on deforestation. Our Earth could basically hold 30% of the gases what we produce, and so from that perspective, you know, I think there's another option to, you know, reduce the emissions. And The second question is basically, what is his take on hydrogen?
Okay, this would take up a lot of time to really discuss
you have three minutes.
Well, here's what I'm going to say about hydrogen. I'm going to remind people, first of all, that with the exception of one place in Africa that I know of, hydrogen does not occur naturally. You have to make hydrogen. And so all of this new buzz about hydrogen, hydrogen is an important answer to what we're trying to do, but it's important as to how we create it. Just like electricity, it's important to how we make electricity, it's important to how we make hydrogen. So if you're using natural gas or fossil fuels to make hydrogen, the hydrogen is considered brown or blue, or, I mean, there are all these colors of hydrogen depending on how it's made. At least this is how it's talked about in the industry.
This is how it's labeled. It's not that actual color.
Correct. But I just saw this week, I haven't even read it yet, but from one of my favorite think tanks, they put out a report on hydrogen, and it's called Solutions versus Delusions.
Uh-huh.
And maybe this is a time to give people my email
Go
address.
Go ahead, man. Yeah.
Which is DeluryDan, DeluryDan, @gmail.com. And Wolfgang, if you want me to send you the link to that, I will. But also, if any of you are interested in being on my newsletter, which comes out roughly every couple of weeks, and Ray reads it immediately
read.
When it comes in.
Well, some of them I read. Some I just read the titles.
But anyway, but if any of you would like to be on my newsletter list, just send me an email at DeluryDan@gmail.com. Okay.
You get that, Wolfgang.
All right.
Okay, so as for deforestation, there's a lot of deforestation going on. There's a little bit of reforestation going on. You mentioned 30%. I think you were talking about retention or removal of CO2, and I'm not sure if that's the right number or not.
I give you an example. Let me give you an example. So when we till the earth, right, especially when the farmers, you know, will sow new crops,
right,
then basically they till the earth, and as a result from the tilling, there is a lot of CO2 released, and the soil is really a good keeper of the balance. And when you look at the maps, you know, in what period of the year we have more release of CO2 gas versus less, then you can see the map is very pointed to the time when the plants or the crops are being sawn out. And
From what I've read, there's a lot that is yet to be known about the power of soil to retain CO2. There are programs now which are paying farmers to not till to retain the CO2, and the farmers are really happy at that kind of a program. But it's not a lot, and it's not as much as certainly a forest or a woodlot would retain, which I think was your original question. But deforestation, and I mean, it's extremely important, the amount of CO2 and other greenhouse gases taken up by forest is a major piece in the overall puzzle.
Wolfgang, thanks for the call. About 6 or 7 minutes left here with Dan DeLury, who is Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law and Graduate School. Let's see here. Which one you want there, boss? Just go ahead. Give me a number, and you got it.
Bob's got a question about hydro.
Okay.
So maybe that's adding something to what we talked about.
You know,
before.
I give you a show and you can't even decide. It's pathetic. Bob in Woodburn, you're on.
How you doing?
Hey.
My question about hydro, I mean, you talk about windmills and the problems they produce with the environment. You talk about solar panels, the land they take up, and the fact that a lot of times they're not recyclable and they do have a limited life. And then you talked about hydro, and you said something about with the rivers and streams and the fish and everything else. I'm in an area where there's a hydroelectric generator down in an aqueduct by the Roundout Reservoir that's been there for probably over 20 years. It's a small brick building with a little fence around it. It's not an eyesore. It's down in an aqueduct. It's not in an open river or waterway where it's affecting fish. Why don't they just do more of those every mile down the aqueduct? It could stick another turbine in and get hydro that way, which is invisible to people. It's not hurting the environment. And like you said, it's no emissions.
Yeah, thanks for that, Bob. And that also goes back to that something that someone said earlier about why don't we have, you know, smaller hydro systems that you can put, you know, in your house. And there actually is work being done on how to harness the flow of water within residential and municipal pipes. You know, because water is always flowing. It's always being pumped around for what we use water for.
Right.
And, you know, technology is trying to pursue a microturbine that could be inserted in some of this water flow and be hauled out.
Well, how much energy you get out of a microturbine?
Every little bit counts.
By the way, I say turbine. Why do you say turbine? Some people say turbine. Some people say turbine.
You're probably right.
Let's call the whole thing. No, frankly, I mean, a lot of people say turbine, but I thought that's something you wear, and a turbine is something that swings around.
Yeah, from my time in the utility sector, we say turbine.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so all you professionals do.
Wind turbine.
All right, but we digress. But we only got a couple minutes. You want to finish up on Bob's answer there?
Oh, no, but that's actually happening to some extent now, Bob. To go back to the Deerfield River once more.
Yeah.
The Deerfield River starts in Vermont, and I've been at the start where you can literally put 1 foot on one side of it and 1 foot on the other side.
Exciting.
And there's a little turbine there. It's in this little old wooden house. Then you go down a bit, and there's another one, and there's another one.
Huh.
And you finally get down to Bear Swamp, and then you get down, you know. So hydro, ideally, you know, you're not wasting the water in any way. The water you put back in the river. And so you can have a lot of hydro on the same
amazing okay.
patch of water, accepting all those other issues that sometimes come up.
Bob, thank you for that one. Let's go to Adams, Mass. Very quickly now. We only have a minute or two, and Jim from Adams can be certainly loquacious. Jim, you're on.
Yay, Ray, and yay, Dan.
All right, sir. You're on. Go about 30 seconds, Jim. Go.
Okay, well, my contention is that the federal government should not have been the one to pick who's going to be a winner and loser in our economic system as far as these transitions from one energy source to another go. And I don't know. I'm not aware of any other incentives offered for other than electric vehicles. If that's so, that's not a good thing, our government choosing the winners and losers. There was an article years ago in a paper, I think the Springfield Republican, about a very small article about a company. Didn't name the company in the article. The company in France had been developing pneumatically powered, pressurized air-powered vehicles. There are so many things that could be developed out there that would get us away from all these dead ends and these
I think you know what you're
our things like lithium batteries and mining the rare earths and everything else.
But I think to your main point,
it's more plentiful than air and a vessel to contain it.
Yeah, okay. But to your main point, Jim, I agree you that we should have a level playing field. The problem is it hasn't been level with respect to introducing wind and solar. The fossil fuel industries have gotten enormous subsidies over the years and still get that today. So if we're going to not have the government pick winners, that's fine. But right now they're picking the wrong winners in many respects.
All right, Dan DeLury. By the way, you got to be very proud of our environmental, the focus we have here, because the air conditioner hasn't worked in like 3 weeks in Studio A, and it's our way of helping out the environment.
Oh,
and
good.
Sweating like a dog here. Hey, man, we're done. Do you have an email address you would like to impart upon our listeners?
Sure, and you can just ask me a specific question, or you can complain or whatever, but okay. I'm at DeLuryDan, DeLuryDan, @gmail.com.
And then that's how you can find out about your newsletter, et cetera?
Oh, yeah, I'll put you on the list if you email me.
You know, man, it's always great to have you here.
And it's great to be here.
And one of these days, I will take you up on your offer to drive that Tesla. Now, remember, we have to do it at the Lebanon Valley Speedway at about 100 miles an hour.
Well, mine gets 0 to 60 in 3 seconds.
3 seconds.
It's like a NASA rocket sled.
Oh, I gotta watch
it's a
you,
lot of fun.
Gotta watch you leave. Support comes from Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, celebrating 26 years, specializing in distinctive eyewear, European styling, and prescription and non-prescription sunglasses. Eye exams by appointment. IdentityEyewearAlbany.com. At Siegel Festival, thanking their artists, staff, patrons, and community for their support and commitment to a successful summer season, SiegelFestival.org. Once again, thanks to Dan DeLury of Vermont Law and Graduate School for being here. Thank you for listening. Great calls. Merlin Argyle, sorry, buddy, we didn't get to you this time. Next time, you know, you're a regular. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, Andrea Leon, screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Astronomy with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. See you then.